Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles.
102.3.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
3 FM Riverside
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Talking about Room 1203, the story behind O.J. Simpson's Las Vegas conviction, and the author is Andy Caldwell. Thank you for being here, Andy.
Well, thank you for having me.
How did it fall into your laps to begin with?
At the time, I was a robbery detective there in Las Vegas, and the robbery occurred in my area of responsibility. So it just, by default, landed in my lap.
But were you surprised? I mean, how do they call? They call, you know, because it's not like he was robbed. It's
when we got that call and told us it was O.J. Simpson, I think we laughed. I mean, that's absurd. You know, you think about what he's gotten away with in the past. Why would he come to Las Vegas and commit a crime like that? So we laughed.
If people watch the show in A&E or read the book, your partner there actually said a few things that we can't say on air.
He did. He sure did.
Yeah, so it was quite a surprise. And so were you skeptical at first, or did you think, oh, we got to go get this guy, or what was your feeling?
Yeah, you know, real skeptical at first. So after we get our laughs, and we did, we got our laughs, then we still had to go there and figure out, okay, why are these people calling and trying to say they got robbed at gunpoint by O.J. Simpson and a few other men? And so it wasn't until we actually got there and my partner went up and looked at the surveillance video that we realized O.J. Simpson really was there. I think initially we were even thinking that our victims might have been a little bit maybe not in touch with reality. So it took a while for us to be convinced.
You must get, especially in Vegas and stuff, there must be calls all the time, you know. People are always trying to get famous and get in touch with celebrities. So it's got to be kind of keep you on the guard, right?
It does, yeah, because in Vegas, you do have them coming and going quite a bit. So you never know what call is going to be real involving a celebrity and what's not.
So you went up to the room, and I enjoyed the encounter that you had with him. But so maybe talk about that when you first came to the room and knocked on the door and you came in. How was he to U.S. police?
Yeah, so, you know, I think what's kind of telling here is, you know, just like he was going to find the real murderer, he wanted to partner up with me and help me get to the bottom of what I had to investigate. So he was incredibly welcoming. You know, we didn't intentionally go in to the interview at his hotel room with 10 detectives. We were just going to go in with 3. But when we went to his hotel room, he just invited everybody in. He was just over-the-top friendly. And, you know, given the moment, you can't blame the guys who weren't supposed to go in. You know, O.J. waved him in and said, hey, come on in, guys. So everybody came in the room. His personality is a little overwhelming at first. And, you know, I write about it a little bit in the book, well, I guess a lot about it in the book, but there is a moment when you're starstruck by the man. You know, fame, infamy, whatever it is, when you stand right there in front of him, his personality is really dynamic and outgoing, and you get caught up in the moment.
Did he ask for a lawyer? What was his first response to you?
When he called, he actually called us and asked for the interview. So he actually had already arranged and made clear that he had a lawyer. However, when we got there, his lawyer wasn't present. So, you know, we were still bound by the rules of Miranda, and he invoked his rights. So when we get there, he told us his lawyer was coming, and that's when he invited us all in to wait for his lawyer. And that's, he made all sorts of statements unsolicited that implicated him in the crime because he just talks. He likes to talk. And, you know, that's where we had our moment, where we have a room with about 10 detectives standing around him. And, you know, as he sits on the corner of his bed, my partner and I are right in front of him. He's playing with his phone in his hand. And that moment happened that I'll never forget. And, you know, he set his phone down in between his legs, sitting on the corner of a bed. And he continued to talk to me for a few moments. And then he looks kind of, you know, lost, and then he accuses me of stealing his phone, and I got caught a little off guard. And luckily my partner, he says, Mr. Simpson, it's between your legs. And when OJ reached down and grabbed that phone, you know, they did a good job of portraying it in the documentary. He grabbed that phone and, you know, he caressed it on his chest. He threw himself backwards on the bed. He started laughing, and he started putting his hands and arms and legs up in the air and just wiggled on the bed. And here we stood, all these detectives in the room, just not knowing what we're looking at. And it went on for about 20 seconds, and that might initially seem like a short time, but it was a really long time of quietness as we watched this man do this. And then he sat right back up as if it didn't happen and continued talking.
Now, do you think that that was a tactic, maybe, that I'm going to have this plan B in my back pocket? If they find me guilty somehow, I'm going to claim mental defect as exhibited by this occurrence.
No, I actually think that he lives in his own world. And in his world, that's completely normal behavior. And he expects it to be normal for everyone who just witnessed it. And it's just after you deal with him more and more, you come to the reality that he does live in a completely different world.
It almost sounds like he's on drugs.
Well, you know, he did have erratic behavior, consistent in my experience with someone who was under the influence of some sort of controlled substance. You know, what that is, I can't tell you, but, you know, he had rapid speech patterns. His movements were very fast. Part of what I write about in the book was one of the things that helped me get over that moment of being starstruck in front of him was the reality that he was wearing the same clothes that he was wearing the day before. And, you know, that kind of sucks you back into that moment of, this is just another, you know, just another guy that I investigate who's a criminal, who's a crook, who's just a street thug committing crimes. And that helped bring it back. But then his behavior also helped see that he's not really deserving of that moment of being enamored with his personality.
Now, when you say that his personality was overwhelming, would you say that would be across the board for everybody? For example, I'm not a sports fan. Don't care. You know, I'm more into the intellectual pursuits. So would he have the same effect on me?
And I think he does.
And by the way, I would barely call Naked Gun a movie. So I don't know if I could call it a movie star.
I was reading the line, right? So.
I think the guy has this inherent ability to be able to charm people. And I think he manipulates that for his own benefit and gain, whatever the circumstance is. So I think he's able to, you know, we had all these audio recordings of him interacting with people before and after the robbery. And you see his ability to shift from memorabilia dealers to, you know, his kind of thug co-defendants to the law enforcement. So you see this kind of chameleon-like personality that caters to each individual person to manipulate them for his own benefit. So, yeah, I think even those outside of sports fans or movie fans, he still has that ability to kind of charm you.
I've seen that in where I work. You know, I work in the corrections environment. But now when you say that he's able to move back and forth, would it be fair to say that perhaps he was exhibiting sociopathic behavior? You know, where they mimic emotions and are able to, like you said, chameleonize themselves into a certain group or a certain environment?
Well, I definitely wouldn't want to, you know, name which category he falls into. But, man, I tell you that was one thing that's definitely noticeable about him. You know, those audio recordings that we had leading up to and planning of the incidents, it really revealed that character trait that he has, that, you know, sitting in a bar with a bunch of, you know, friends that he's planning a crime with, you know, he's very different than he was when he interacted with law enforcement, very different than how he interacted when you saw him in courts or you know, when you saw him at his parole hearing. He does transform very easily, and he appeals to his audience.
He's kind of used to that. He was a star for quite a few years, so he probably got used to, smooth talking and you know, carousing with people.
Sure, and I believe there's this expectation he has that everybody will do what he wants. You know, part of the reason he got rearrested, or his bail bondsman revoked his bail and, you know, rearrested and brought him back from Florida. And part of that reason was he was trying to manipulate witnesses through the bail bondsman. He was asking the bail bondsman to call co-defendants and ask them to tell him the messages from OJ to his co-defendants, which he wasn't allowed to do. And clearly we have a voicemail and he expects that to happen. There's no, this might happen. You know, there's an expectation you will do this. And luckily the bail bondsman had the integrity to say, no, I'm not involving myself in this, and rearrested him.
Yeah. That's witness intimidation.
Well, it's definitely a violation of the conditions of the parole. He definitely was not allowed to have any conversation between he and the co-defendants. Yeah, he definitely, you know, I think we saw it also exhibited pretty strongly in his parole hearing. You know, his parole hearing was, it was dishonest as dishonest gets. But his expectation is everybody believes what he just said, regardless of its actual, you know, truth.
We see that with people that are rich and famous a lot.
Right, almost living in their own bubble.
Yeah, and they're used to having people around them that do a lot for them, so that's just... comes with it. Now, did he actually have a gun himself?
No, we never established that he had a gun. But, you know, what we had was, and this is one of those misrepresentations that he made at this parole hearing, that he consistently stuck with this story that he never knew there was a gun. And there's an audio recording we have that's very poor quality, but it occurred after the robbery happened. And during this recording, O.J. Simpson's heard saying, to his co-defendant, hey, you never pulled that piece out in the hall, right? And the co-defendant says, no. And then he then says, well, when they look at the video, they'll have nothing then. So
that is straight That is straight coaching right there.
Yes. And that audio recording was so wonderful because I think it's the strongest piece of evidence to corroborate what the witnesses said, that he asked them to bring firearms and that there were, in fact, firearms in the room because, you know, he has consistently said there were no guns. Or that he saw no guns, it's so absurd, it's hard to believe, but once you get to see and know his personality, he lives in this alternate world that truth doesn't matter to him. What he creates, he expects you to believe.
Well, he got away with one of the biggest crimes in this century just on that alone.
Well, according to his parole hearing testimony, he said he's never been accused of using a weapon against anybody.
Yeah, he said he has never been violent, right? I mean,
right. He said that.
and
so, you know, but I think that's what made the case so fascinating is, you know, you have this guy that's so far out there. And, you know, one of my biggest gripes, one of the reasons I wrote the book, was because I always hear these same kind of storylines of didn't he steal his own stuff back? You know, was it really a crime? In all actuality, it wasn't his own property back, and it was a crime. And I think, you know, if people give my book a chance, what they'll find out that, hey, this was a really violent encounter. It was a crime that he committed, and he deserves to go to prison for what he did.
Well, can you maybe run over the crime in a quick form? So if people don't know exactly what he was arrested and sent to jail for, what was it exactly?
There was a memorabilia dealer in Southern California, a man named Tom Riccio, who was aware of some family heirlooms that were floating around out there that belonged to O.J. Simpson at one point in time. Tom Riccio was aware that Simpson had just lost the rights to the book he wrote, If I Did It, and he was no longer going to get any proceeds from that book. So Tom Riccio was able to kind of manipulate O.J. Simpson's emotions and get him into a contract to exclusively sign some of those books for Tom Riccio. In return, Tom Riccio was going to connect him with some family heirlooms. That was the initial plan, and it all fell apart. So O.J. Simpson probably thought there was going to be different items in that room than what were actually there. And so what ends up happening is for O.J. Simpson to agree to sign these books for Tom Riccio, Tom Riccio agrees to get O.J. Simpson in touch with these family heirlooms in Las Vegas. Well, when the family heirlooms kind of fall apart, there's a last minute fill in of, hey, let's just bring some O.J. Simpson memorabilia, and we'll just bring O.J. to that, and maybe that'll work, and he'll still sign the books for me. O.J. decided to do a little bit of side planning where he contacted some men to come with him as security to bring guns, and they were just going to steal the property back. And that's where it all fell apart. So the property in the room at in Las Vegas was not what he thought it was going to be. And what ended up being in the room was memorabilia of, it was O.J. Simpson memorabilia. There was also Joe Montana memorabilia, Duke Snyder, Pete Rose, West Point memorabilia. And when he came in, he just stole everything. Again, thinking it was somebody else's. And, you know, I know that's kind of a short explanation, but it is somewhat of a complex storyline behind what actually happened.
Yeah. I actually have his rookie card.
Do you really?
Yeah. You know, if you have his number, I can, if you can get him to sign my card for me, that would be...
Well, you know, there was this moment when so the DA asked me to serve him with a notice of intent to seek indictment. So he was in jail already. And my partner and I, we had to go down to the jail, and we had to ask the jail to bring him up. Now, this is the first time he was in jail for one day at this point, and we were made aware that he was causing problems even internally for the jail staff because inmates wanted to see him. If he walked down the hallway, people would they would make their way to the window so they could get a glimpse of O.J. Simpson walking by in, you know, the blues and shackles. So when we went to go serve him this notice, we did it in a place that was a little bit more secluded, and Eddie and I were in a room and inside the jail, and we were sitting down at the table just waiting for Simpson to be brought into us. And we hear him coming down the hall because you can hear the ankle chains just dragging on the concrete. And you hear the key go into the door, and the corrections officer opens the door up, and here comes O.J. Simpson. And, you know, the guy's looking down on the ground like, you know, somebody stole his bag of candy on Halloween. And then he makes eye contact with me, and the guy lights up like we're long-lost friends. And, you know, gives me the, hey, buddy, how you doing? You know, sits there and tries to chat us up like, like he's trying to catch up. But the reality was Eddie and I were really busy at that time, and I didn't have time to chat with him. I needed him to sign a form and move on. So I slide this form off, and he tries to kind of chat me up some more, and I tell him, listen, you don't have to sign the form. I'll sign it for you. All you do is give it to you at this point. And he finally says, okay, and he signs it and gives it back to me. After about a 10-minute interaction with him, my partner and I were walking out of the jail, and, you hold this document that he just signed, you look down, and there's this kind of famous signature, and you think, wow, that's the signature that starts the whole court process on one single document. So,
again,
for all the money he made off signatures, that one that one put him in.
Where is all of that memorabilia now?
Well, it went to the California courts, just like he said in his parole hearing, but ultimately something like 98% of it went back to the victim, Bruce Fromong. There were a few items, I think Bruce said about 16, that do legally belong to him. However, he could not present, you know, evidence or receipts of them, so he didn't get them back. So the victim got back over 600 items that were stolen. And another thing that's not talked about much is there's still property that I was unable to recover. There's still memorabilia. I recovered some I recovered some of the Joe Montana stuff, Pete Rose stuff, but there's still Duke Snyder stuff that was never recovered, and Pete Rose stuff never recovered. But I actually, about 2 years after the incident, the victim contacted me to let me know he had got the property back, and he sold me three of the pictures that were stolen from the room, which was kind of a nice gesture of him. But he turned around and sold most of those documents. He sold them on eBay and Amazon for about $299 a picture, I think, $299 a picture.
$299 a picture?
Yeah, he was selling them for quite a bit of money.
So what was the biggest surprise you felt? Like, this is the first time you ever met O.J. Simpson, and what surprised you most about him?
How small he was. In fairness, I'm a big guy. I mean, I'm 6'5", 300 pounds. So I just, when you open the door, I was surprised. I mean, the guy's head is huge. His head, it's almost like Darth Vader, you know, you stand in front of him, and his head is just enormous. But as far as his stature, he wasn't a big imposing individual. And then I guess the second thing that caught me off guard was just how over-the-top charismatic the man was.
What kind of feedback are you getting about your book and about the whole O.J. Simpson Vegas story?
So my book is, I think it's carrying about a 4.8 rating on Amazon. I'm getting a lot of really positive feedback. Now, there clearly is a small percentage of the fan base that he has, and I'm pretty sure it's mostly people that don't work, because it seems like most of the messages I get that are really negative come during normal work hours. So there are some people, and the most creative one, I'll give her credit. She did her own research because she found out I was a pastor now. And she asked me if I praised God with my lying lips. I've been called a corrupt pig. I should keep a list of all the things that people have written me. But in general, most people are really receptive. I think also most people are unaware of what happened. You know, when Kim Goldman interviewed me last week, those were her thoughts, was she didn't know the details of the crime. You know, obviously she knew the conviction and the sentencing, but and I don't think most people know what actually happened in that room. I think most people just go with what the defense said, that he tried to steal his own property back and got caught.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of armchair detectives, you know, a lot of those nowadays. And
yeah, you know, Simpson made this interesting statement, because the crime that happened in Las Vegas was directly connected to the civil settlements where, you know, he owes the Goldmans and Browns for the wrongful death of Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman. And so it comes back to trying to hide property or assets from them so he doesn't actually have to, you know, give them money. And what was really interesting is we had a recording of O.J. Simpson after the robbery talking about the property, fully aware that it wasn't the property he thought it was, that it included sports memorabilia of other players. And what he tells his co-defendants is he tells them something along the lines of, hey, you guys just keep this stuff because if you guys don't, it'll just go to the Goldmans anyways.
Wow.
Right, you see this motivation behind it is to hide property, move property, keep it away from them.
That's almost like offshore accounting.
Right, well, you think about the nature of the sports memorabilia world. So if Bruce Fromong, the victim, who used to be a partner in a business with O.J. Simpson, if he buys a picture for $5, you know, an 8x10. Now he takes it to OJ and he says, hey, you sign this for $10. And then he turns around and signs it for $50. OJ, for just simply a moment of his time, gets $10 under the table. And then the memorabilia dealer, he's going to clear himself $35 because, you know, he has 15 invested in it. And now you take that process and you duplicate it 500 times fold, and there's a lot of money being made under the table.
I heard this. Now, this came from Shapiro and the lawyer from his first trial. And he said that the judge gave him 33 years in this conviction. One represented each million that he owed the Goldmans. Do you believe that? Or
No. But, I love the parallels.
Yeah.
But, you know, if we look for parallels, in most things in life, we can find some sort of parallel. So his prison sentence was 15 to 33 years. But what you'll find is for every individual crime that he was charged with, you know, there's a sliding scale of what the appropriate sentence is. And when you just simply add up what the jury convicted him of, it just happened to be 33. You know, on that note, if had it been 32 years, of course, Shapiro would probably say, well, it was 32 years because that's his number of his football jersey. People would have always found a reason for it, I think it kind of goes back to humanity's desire to not hold individuals accountable. You know, he got held individually accountable, not because of outside influences, because he's a criminal. He's a violent felon, and he got what he deserved.
What did you think of the parole hearing overall?
He lied. And
it's that simple. It's that simple.
You know, I got to tell you, it was very frustrating because there was a moment in the hearing where he kind of snapped at the parole board member. And I guess in my mind, I hoped that the parole board member was going to maybe yank OJ's chain a little bit, you know, identify how inappropriate that was. But nothing happened. And so, though I do respect our criminal justice system, and I understand that was his time for parole, I just don't think you should be rewarded for being dishonest.
We deal with that a lot with the justice system overall. A lot of the people we talk to and do interviews, there's a lot of that. It's the system that we have, so...
Hey, and on a very surface level, I will tell you, I enjoyed that the Attorney General of Florida said we didn't want him back in Florida, and for all his stated intentions to go to Florida, I do enjoy that he is now living in Las Vegas.
What is your plan now, like with the book and everything? Like, do you plan to go further with it, do talks on it, write more books now?
I still talk at conferences, at law enforcement conferences. I find that people still enjoy the topic, and some of the pitfalls that I had during the investigation all related to his celebrity. So I still do give conference talks. I contemplated writing another book. I have had some positive feedback, so that's encouraging. So, I guess the future is kind of wide open for that.
Have you met O.J. Simpson since the book or since all this has happened or talked to him?
No, but his lawyer has sent me a couple messages. So,
Such as?
Are they nice?
No. His lawyer is an interesting guy. I think he primarily was a personal injury lawyer at first. He has accused me of being a liar and misrepresented because... Yeah. He didn't like the documentary and how the documentary represented his client. Luckily I have the facts on my side. So yeah. I don't have to live in OJ's world. I can live in the world of truth.
Yeah, but now that he's out, aren't you a little bit worried?
No. I actually think that I don't think he could care about me. I think he enjoys the attention. You know, I saw this clip of him in a white SUV the night after he was released from prison. And the media kind of rushed him at a gas station and started talking to him. And the guy could have ended the conversation by closing the door and leaving the window up. But he didn't. He engaged in conversation. He engaged the reporters. And he likes to be in the limelight too much, so I'm not really worried about him.
Yeah, I would see that. So what's the biggest thing people are going to get out of your book?
They're going to find out that he didn't steal his own property, Matt. That it was actually, it was a crime, regardless of, the conspiracy theories or wanting to find that maybe we prosecuted him for what California didn't do. There is an undeniable connection between the two cases, but it had nothing to do with that. And so I think that's what they're going to find. They're going to find that there's an actual crime. And I think they'll also get a glimpse into police culture in the fact that, sometimes people, they see law enforcement as being very stoic and they don't give us the ability to have personalities. And so I think they'll probably see some personality in the book of, we laugh just like anyone else does. We hurt like anyone else does. And I think they'll see that throughout the book.
And that's fair. I mean, that is absolutely fair. People need to know the other side. They need to look at you as a person, not just this person, or not just this machine that, was, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, somebody that tormented one of their heroes.
Right. And I think maybe that's another thing people will see in the book is that I honestly tried to the best of my ability to investigate every aspect of this case. And that way, when I presented it to the DA's office, I presented everything. If there was a possible alibi, I investigated it thoroughly. I presented it. If there was an alternate theory, I did everything I could to give them everything, whether it was good or bad, for the prosecution of O.J. Simpson.
Fair enough. Like Al was saying, now that the story is out and it's been on television and the book, you know, the books are rolling, how much celebrity status have you gained? I mean, are you doing more lectures? Are you in higher demand?
So part of this, I think, happens because, you know, when you put yourself out there and you're retired, you're more easily accessible. Last week would be a prime example. I got phone calls from a Fox News reporter, CNN, and also some local reporters out of Las Vegas that was curious if I would be willing to give comment on air about the shooting in Las Vegas. So I find that opportunities have presented themselves like that, but it's really nothing I want to pursue, at least right now.
You wouldn't want to be like a commentator on Fox or something.
No, I'm not really interested. But I will tell you this. When I went to the parole hearing, I met Mark Furman for the first time and just, you know, exchanged some pleasantries with him. In fact, I would say that when he asked me if I would do an on-air interview with him, and when I declined, he wasn't he wasn't that friendly after that.
He wasn't that friendly, yeah. Yeah.
But he agreed to take a picture with me. And so I take the picture and I zip it off to my wife and I text it to her. And you know, lickety-split, within about 3 minutes, my wife texts me something back and I open it up and my wife had created this meme. And the picture, she said, one of these guys put O.J. Simpson in prison and the other one didn't. So I quickly told my wife to please delete that.
No, because
unfortunately, I think that... Well, believe me, I had to twist my wife's arm to get her to not post that.
Post it.
He's
one of my friends. I can send it to him.
I didn't want to stir that hornet's nest, but I got to tell you, it was funny.
That's funny.
My partner and I, we taught a high profile investigation class for our department for years, and he would start off with the introductions that, you know, how many of you know who Mark Furman is? And, you know, of course, most cops do. Whether you have a negative opinion or a positive opinion of him, most cops still know who he is. And then my partner would say, well, you know, how many of you know Andy Caldwell? And yeah, a couple people would know. And then my partner would say, well, that's what you get for doing your job right, and that's what you get for doing your job wrong.
Wow.
Which, you know, was there's always nice to hear. So.
And all of this based on a glove that didn't fit.
Well, you know what's funny is in the presentation I do now, I did quite a bit of research. In fact, I think Mark Furman's book is amazing. I read Marsha Clark's book, and I tried to read Chris Darden's book. I just couldn't get through it. He's just too angry. But, one of my hardest things to swallow was when he was confronted about, you know, saying a racial slur.
Yeah.
To say yes, it's not a big deal. Sometimes I think cops, we get so caught up in trying to maintain this image that we don't want to admit our failure. But just admit, I mean, we're people. We make mistakes. Let it happen.
Yeah. I think with him, but it was a little bit more particular because he was pretty graphic and he said a lot of really bad things. It's not so much the use of the word, but I think it's the context of it. But
I think you're right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, it's something that you could never come back to. But the problem was they painted him to be a racist, which it sounds like he is. And then they tried to work the system as in, okay, that's the reason he did things. And that was, it's hard to come back from that.
You know, I think that's probably one of the reasons that I was well suited for the case. In fact, you know, when we were done with the case, and I say we because it affected my wife as well, I didn't want anything to do with O.J. Simpson. I had no interest. We were approached by two people about writing a book at the time, and I just wasn't interested. I just wanted to close the book, impound it, and be done with it.
Yes.
Because it did. It consumed so much of my life, and primarily because, you know, I had close to 15 hours of covert audio recordings that I had to transcribe, and it took months to do. So I was just done. And so I guess because I wasn't interested in pursuing anything at the time, I was well suited for being the lead detective on the case.
And people need to keep in mind that while you're doing all this transcribing and O.J. Simpson cases consuming so much of you, he's not your only case. You have a lot of other things going on.
Initially, we did, but the DA's office actually called our police department and specifically request that Eddie and I do nothing but work on that case. You know, and for their own reasons, I think the reasons were righteous, but it did afford us an opportunity to do things we normally wouldn't do, explore possibilities that we never would have explored. So that was a good thing. But yes, even though it was our case we were working, Eddie and I still had to respond to other cases. We wouldn't be the primary or lead on, but we still had to respond. Las Vegas Metro Homicide, absolutely the best detectives you're going to find in the nation. There aren't going to be many people that can hold a candle to them. And I promise you, they are doing everything they can. In fact, I would even go as far as to say the two guys or the squad that's actually handling the major lifting, they probably know so much more than what is being released to the media that it would probably overwhelm us if we knew what they knew at this time. So there's a lot of speculation going on, and there's a lot of people coming up with these theories. And the guys working the case have probably already, they've probably considered these, they've probably investigated them, but, you know, there's not a lot of time to constantly be briefing people when you're trying to interview large amounts of people, trying to control information. And so I guess if I was going to make a comment, I would just tell people to trust the detectives working the case. They're highly skilled, and when it's all said and done, they have the best interests of the public at heart, and they'll give a full explanation to the best of their ability when it's done.
And people got to relax on the, you know, how are the these conspiracy theories, how do they affect you when you're doing a case? Because there's so many out there, you know. So, and with O.J., there was probably lots, and like you touched off on with, conspiracies around him and stuff. How does that affect your police work?
They are so incredibly time-consuming. And, you know, I mentioned something earlier. Sometimes people, they don't want to hear a simple explanation. They want it to be something very complex. And so in their minds, you know, they want more of a conspiracy. But the moment they present that conspiracy, even as far-fetched as it is, you're obligated to investigate it. So it can be time-consuming. It can waste resources. So sometimes those conspiracy theories, they're detrimental to the case.
Yeah, they do more damage than good.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I had a murder in Las Vegas back in 2004, and we had the case solved. It was, you know, unfortunately, it was a vagrant who poured gasoline on the top of a guy's head and lit him on fire. And the victim's fiance, she just could not accept that that humanity could do that. There had to be, you know, an outside influence. There had to be more behind it. And, you know, she tried to make it about the Asian mafia, how, you know, they were extorting people. And so she wasted so much of my time and resources investigating that and being able to prove to her and now to a jury that that was nonsense. That it was definitely remarkable how much we had to waste on that.
Yeah.
Now, is that simply out of due diligence? Or, I mean, certainly, you know, some of this stuff is just absurd.
Right. Well, in this case, in the shooting case, it might be a little bit different. But if you're going to prosecute somebody for a crime, you know, if there's evidence out there that might help a defendant, it's exculpatory in some way, you have to then give it to the defense. So if somebody comes forward with a conspiracy theory that even has a remote shred of possibility, well, in honesty, all conspiracy theories, you should give them to the defense. Now, it gives the defense wiggle room to create that reasonable doubt. And rather than giving them the conspiracy alone that creates reasonable doubts, out of due diligence as an investigator, you should be investigating it fully. So when you give it to the defense, you also give them why, as an investigator, you were able to debunk it. So it can minimize damage in the future, in the prosecution.
That's got to be hard to do, because you can't always debunk a theory because there's just not enough evidence.
Right. You just get to the best place you can with what you were provided. And I guess the most important thing is you don't sweep it under the rug. Once it comes to the surface, you got to address it. It creates tons of work.
Yeah, I was going to say that. So it's got to be putting a load on the cops right now in Vegas, because there's so much flying around. And most of it comes from the Internet, too. That's the worst part.
Yeah, I've watched videos about the shooter on the fourth floor and the theories behind it. And it's just absurd. And the implication on some of these theories are that it's a government conspiracy.
Right.
And
it was Hillary Clinton is what I was told.
Well, yeah, my high-level sources tell me she did it herself.
Yeah, she was on the fourth floor.
Sometimes people are just, they're bad by nature and they do bad things. And so it doesn't have to be this huge, clearly it can be large conspiracies, but it doesn't have to be. I guess we do have to look at Occam's razor. I think he might have knew what he was talking about there.
Yeah, and so that touches off on cops and shootings and even racism. And what's your thought on that, being in the police force in Vegas, and the high number of shootings that come out on TV now and stuff? Do you feel there's a racist element in the police force? And I know that's a loaded question. You can't say yes, but...
I'm going to tell you no. I'm going to absolutely tell you no. I'm going to tell you from my experience with the people I worked around for almost 20 years on that department, that you call me in the middle of the night and say somebody's in your house, I'm not going to ask you what's your race, what's your sex, what's your gender, what's your preferences. I'm going to come help you to the best of my ability. I don't care what neighborhood you're in, I'm coming. Every person I ever worked with would have the same mentality. We want to help the public. We want to come to a resolution, a righteous resolution to whatever your problem is. I think one of the things about those body cameras that police are wearing now, if you ask me, they should be rolling all the time. There shouldn't be times where law enforcement has to turn them off. And right now there are. People can ask you or request you to turn them off. And as far as I'm concerned, as a public official, you should be able to record every bit of your interaction and let people see what law enforcement actually sees. And I think it would shock most of our public.
Yeah. Well, that when we had the chief of police from Seattle on, he sort of hinted toward lack of training as a problem. And what's your thoughts on that? Then if it's not race and there's not a race or sexual problem here, why are we seeing so much more of this on TV?
Well, I think it fits a narrative that the media wants to put forward. But real quick on what the Seattle police chief said, I do think that there is a lack of training in some departments. I think Las Vegas Metro is on the cutting edge of that. But I do think there is value in training of de-escalation, of, trying to get people to calm the situation and bring everything down a level. And I think that's something it's valuable training for police departments to pursue. Let's de-escalate. Let's focus on de-escalation. Those claims of racism in law enforcement, numerically, they just statistically, they're not there. But unfortunately, I think, we get a story from Jimmy, and now Jimmy's word is gospel, and now we're going to repeat it. And so we form our opinions off of other people's opinions and not facts. And suddenly, if you just look at the facts, there's not this systemic racism or oppression that's coming from law enforcement.
It's been great talking to you. So now the book is out and available, of course, and they can get it at all fine bookstores. And it's by Wild Blue Press, so it's on their website and, of course, Amazon. It's called Room 1203, and it's the story behind O.J. Simpson's Las Vegas conviction. And the author's Andy Caldwell. Geez, I'm, and well, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.